The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening, everybody. Hello again. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Phil Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 21st day of August. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is right across the way. Got a nice show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we have a hero of the 1975 World Series, former outfielder for the Red Sox and Cincinnati Reds, Bernie Carbo, will join us. In the second half, we'll welcome in the drummer for Massapequa's own Stray Cats, also a big baseball fan. Slim Jim Phantom will be here. He's got a new book out called A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a former outfielder and DH who played from 69 through 1980 for the Cincinnati Reds, the Cardinals, the Boston Red Sox, Milwaukee Brewers, Cleveland Indians, and Pittsburgh Pirates. He was a hero of the 1975 World Series while with the Bo Sox. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Bernie Carbo. Bernie, good evening.
Hey, Bill, how are you in New York?
Great.
Long Island, New York. I like to
say
hello to my friend Joe Pepitone lives in Long Island.
He sure does.
Joe Pepitone.
I run into Joe once in a while in Costco. I see him shopping around once in a while.
Good man.
Still hanging in there. Yeah, I saw him a couple of months ago.
All right.
Bernie, you grew up in the Detroit area. I don't know if I need to ask or not, but who were your favorite teams, any idols, any favorite players while you were growing up?
Well, of course, I was a Detroit Tiger fan.
Okay.
Charlie Maxwell was Mr. Sunday, hit home runs on Sunday, and, of course, Al Kaline. And, of course, my favorite ball player was Willie Mays. I was always a Willie Mays fan, but growing up, in Detroit, Al Kaline and Willie Horton, Reno Petroia, and, it was just a great team, but didn't win a lot because the New York Yankees were so good in the 50s and 60s. And then my first ball game I watched as a kid, I watched the 1968 Tigers, Oakland. Denny McClain won his 31st game, and I believe Reggie Jackson at that time hit one on top of the roof at Tiger Stadium.
So yeah, I remember that one.
My first big league game. Denny McClain won his 31st game. But when I ran into Denny later, he was playing the piano in Detroit. And I went up to introduce him. He says, yeah, Bernie Carbo, let me think. If you had faced me, your batting average would be less than 200.
Yeah, Denny was up in Cooperstown on induction weekend.
Yeah.
So we ran into him up there.
He's really changed his life around. He's a really good guy. He's doing really well. I'm happy for him.
He sure is. Now, you started your career with Cincinnati, Bernie. You were the Reds' number one draft pick in 1965, ahead of Johnny Bench.
Yeah, Johnny's still not very happy about that. he's wondering why I got drafted in front of him. Matter of fact, when I got down to Tampa playing at Al Lopez Field, he came over and he said, you're the number one draft choice? I said, yeah. He said, how much did you sign for? And of course, I was a 17-year-old kid. I said, $30,000. And he got really upset with me. He kind of walked away. I found out he got a pair of shoes and a glove and less about $5,000. But then we roomed together in the minor leagues as we went. And I admired Johnny Bench. His mom and dad were from Bingham, Oklahoma. I got a chance to stay with them when I was in the Army Reserves. But treated his family really well. One of the best, greatest catchers. I played with some great catchers. Played with Carlton Fisk, Johnny Bench, and Manny Sanguin. And Ted Simmons.
Right.
People don't want to talk about Ted Simmons, but he belongs in the Hall of Fame, too.
He could rake. Yeah.
Yeah, good hitter.
And now, in 1970, you had career highs in every offensive category. The Reds are the NL champs. You really broke in with a bang. You finished second in the NL Rookie of the Year vote to Carl Morton of the Expos. I think he won 18 games that year. But it was a great ball club. Tell us a little bit about Tony Perez, Pete Rose, Sparky Anderson.
Well, the Big Red Machine, you know, Pete Rose belongs in the Hall of Fame. I said that on ESPN about a month or two ago. I said, you know, Pete Rose belongs in the Hall of Fame because if you really want to look at the Hall of Fame, it's a good, bad, and ugly. And it's mm-hmm. just a Hall of Fame. It's just... You know, it's just a baseball Hall of Fame, and Pete Rose belongs there. And I want Pete to get in, you know, before something happens to him that he won't be able to be alive to watch himself get into the Hall of Fame. He doesn't belong in baseball. The rule states if you bet on baseball, you're no longer in baseball. But he, you know, doesn't say anything about the Hall of Fame. He belongs here. But I play with David Concepcion, belongs in the Hall of Fame, too.
Great shortstop.
As a shortstop, yeah. And he belongs here, too. George Foster was a great player. I played with Joe Morgan, Tommy Helms, Lee May, Tony Perez, the Big Red Machine, Bench, of course. And we just had a great team, great hitting. But the 1975 team with Freddie Lynn and Jimmy Rice, nobody remembers that Jimmy Rice broke his wrist. And we didn't have him in the 75 World Series. We had a good team. I think if we had Jimmy Rice as a Hall of Famer in our lineup. You know, I wrote in my book, Saving Bernie Carbo, I said, you know, losing Jimmy Rice in that World Series was like losing Tony Perez. He goes, no, I read your book. You got to, like, it's like losing Johnny Bench.
Yeah.
I said, no. I said, Tony Perez. Perez had a bomb in one of those games when we told Bill Lee, Bill, don't throw Tony Perez a looper pitch. And Tony Perez took it deep over the Green Monster. I come running in. I said, Bill, man, we told you not to throw that blooper pitch. He said, well, I just want to see if you were telling the truth. I said, yeah, I went 500 feet over the fence, man. That was a 75. I think the game six was probably the greatest game ever played in baseball at World Series time when Dwight Evans made a great catch in right field.
Yeah.
Doubled off, and Joe Morgan thought it was a home run. And, you know, I took the worst swing and hit one out of the ballpark, and it was an amazing World Series Game 6. I thought we went ahead 3-1 in the seventh game and ended up losing 4-3. But one of the things, Jim Burton was the relief pitcher, the rookie who gave up the game-winning blooper hit and never played another day in the big leagues. And I one of the things you do when you play in a World Series, one of the things I don't want to ever do was to miss a ball or lose a game because I did something wrong. But after I hit that home run in the eighth inning on a worst swing, and I tied it up 6-6, and that's when Carlton Fisk waved the ball fair. People
right.
will remember that.
Exactly.
Carlton Fisk waving it fair. But I went out to left field, and on the 3-2 pitch, the ball was down the line, and I reached back and caught the ball. I come back and told Yaz, I said, man, I almost missed that ball, Yaz. He was, like, looking at me like, maybe we should put Miller in left field. But, you know, I was just watching a program on baseball that had some things happen in baseball where people were being crucified still today. And one was the guy out in the Chicago Cubs, and the other one was for the Red Sox when it went under Bill Buckner's leg.
Oh, yeah, they still kill him, yeah.
Yeah, they still kill him about that, the ball that went through his legs. I mean, they had the champagne in the clubhouse. Red Sox are going to drink it up. Go to the World Series in 86. Ball goes through his legs, and, you know, it's a sad thing. That's why I never in the World Series, you really don't want to do something that people remember for a long time unless it's good.
Unless it's good,
you know,
right.
I did that home run 42 years ago. 42 years ago, people still remember my home run. They still debate if mine was better than Fisk. But I still go to New England. I'm in the Diamond Club ministry, and because of that home
right.
run, I go to speak in prisons, jails, detention homes, halfway houses, churches. I do Little League, Babe Ruth clinics. I do a lot of things around that New England area. And I've been doing it for 22 years, just going up there and giving the gospel of Jesus Christ and leading people and, you know, trying to tell them, hey, look, I made a lot of bad decisions in my life, and I paid for them. And, you know, the first drink I had, I remember, I didn't like the taste, but I ended up having a lot of problems, and especially with drugs and everything. And the problems that they're having now with the heroin and whatever, you know, I talk about Jesus Christ and hope in Christ and by the grace of God that, you know, you can turn away from these things. And I've been clean now for 22 years.
That's great, Bernie. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
As we probably know, Bernie went from the Reds to the Cards, where he played with guys like Torrey Brock, played for Red Shanedienst, another Hall of Famer, traded to Boston with Rick Wise for a guy named Reggie Smith, who was a great outfielder, switch hitter, and Ken Tatum. Now, you went to Boston, as we were discussing, Bernie. You really had an admiration for Tom Yawkey, but I read somewhere when you met Yawkey, he was in the clubhouse shining shoes, and you went up and gave him a $20 bill and told him to get you a hamburger and some fries.
Yeah, and I didn't know he owned the team.
That's a good one.
I was the first player to go to arbitration. I wanted a $10,000 raise.
Yeah.
I lost, and I went to Mr. Yawkey and said, look, you know, I'm going to have another baby. I'm going to buy a house. I'm looking at a house in Framingham. I need the $10,000. And about 3 days later, there was an envelope in my locker with a check, $10,000 that he gave me. Never took a penny out of my check. That was the first time probably in my career that I played for the uniform. I played for the old man, Mr. Yawkey, that loved me, and I loved him. And it was a great city to play in, Fenway Park. But the funniest thing was when I got to Boston, they said, hey, Bernie Carbo, good Italian boy, good Italian boy.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'm not Italian. Yeah, you're Italian. So the next day they put that I was Italian for, you know, so for 4 years playing in Boston, I'm Italian. And I remember like Joe Pepitone in New York said,
yeah,
where's Carbo? We're going to throw you in a river. You're not Italian. But the funny thing about it, about 6 years ago, I get this baseball card sent to me, and it's from Pennsylvania, the Italian Hall of Fame. And I have 50 cards, and in the 50 cards and the 50 players that are Italian that are Hall of Famers is me.
Yeah.
So I call the CEO, and I says, look, I'm Bernie Carbo. Hey, Bernie Carbo, hi, you got you in the Baseball Hall of Fame, the Italian Hall of Fame. I said, look, man, I'm not Italian. He said, Bernie Carbo's Italian. He hung up on me.
Oh, man.
So,
tough crowd.
Hall of Fame. I'm Italian. I'm in the Italian Hall of Fame, man.
There you go.
I also
found out, Bernie, you were part of the Buffalo Heads. Now, I want you to tell the folks what that is with Bill the Spaceman Lee and Fergie Jenkins, a great Hall of Famer. What were the Buffalo Heads?
Right. Well, the Buffalo Head Gang was, you would think it was about drugs and drinking and whatever, but it really wasn't, you know. They were all pitchers, Rick Wise, Jim Willoughby, and Fergie Jenkins and Bill Lee, and I was friends with them. You know, I loved Zim, but they hated Zim. Zim hated them, and Zim, you know, put him in the bullpen, wouldn't pitch him and stuff.
Yeah.
So Fergie started putting Zimmer's head, he put his body on a buffalo and started putting him in the locker room, you know, a picture of Zimmer with his body but the head of the buffalo. And found out that Fergie was doing that. I said, Fergie, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. Zim's going to be mad. He says, well, you know, you shoot the lead buffalo and none of them run. I said, you know, they didn't care for Don Zimmer. And Zimmer had a meeting and said, I don't know who's putting these pictures up. If I find out, but I think the Buffalo Head Gang, everybody looks at it a little bit different. But I think the biggest thing I did, and people remember, is Mighty Joe Young.
Mighty Joe Young, the stuffed gorilla.
Yeah. My stuffed gorilla dressed up in a baseball uniform, I would put it on the bench and take it on the plane, seatbelt it in, get a free meal for him, and I'd eat it and take him out every place I went. He got more. Players were jealous of him because he got more publicity than they did. And the thing about it was, Scipio Spinks pitched for the Cardinals, and he threw about 93, 94, hurt his arm, and he brought in a psychiatrist to tell him he didn't have a sore arm. So he brought in the monkey and put it in a uniform and told the psychiatrist, look, tell the monkey to pitch because I can't pitch.
Yeah.
So when I got traded to Boston, he sent it to me, opened up the box, and right there was Mighty Joe Young.
Yeah.
So you know how ball players are superstitious.
Sure.
When I put up on the bat rack and we started winning in Boston, everybody wanted the bat, you know, the monkey on the bat rack. And I remember Red Chandings was superstitious too. So, but, you know, Mighty Joe Young was got a lot of publicity and players didn't like it. But I remember Louis Tien had a religion that he would wear white all the time, turtleneck and stuff. So I dressed my monkey. I went to the dime store and dressed him up like Louis. And Louis got mad and he put him in the middle of the clubhouse, poured alcohol on him, set him on fire.
Oh, man.
He said, I killed that monkey. I killed that monkey. But, yeah, it was quite a deal. But I had a lot of fun with that. I had a lot of fun playing baseball. You know, that's one of the things I don't really understand why players today don't have more fun.
Speaking of Zim and not liking Zim, it was Bill the Spaceman Lee who gave him the nickname the Gerbil, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bill, you know, Bill lives up in Vermont.
Yeah.
And I hear he's running for mayor.
Yeah, he'd probably win.
My wife said he's running for governor.
Yeah.
I said, wow, you know, governor of Vermont. Yeah, he's a piece of work. I love Bill. He's, you know, he's still pitching, still keeping his earned run averages and stuff, and pitching in a, he's about, I'm 69. He's got to be close to 70, 71 years old, still throwing the ball. So he enjoys, they love baseball. Got to love the game, you know what I mean?
Stay active. That's definitely it. You're right.
Yeah, you know, I do a fantasy camp. You go to BernieCarbo.com. And I do a fantasy camp with old guys at Hank Aaron Stadium in Mobile, Alabama. The last weekend of March is a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You come in, you play at Hank Aaron Stadium Friday night, play Saturday and Sunday. We have a great time, banquet. Put a uniform on all the old guys, and we go out there and throw the ball around and play. And I tell you, we have a great time. I've been doing it for 22 years. And the reason I do it is it's only $300. If you bring a friend, it's $150.
Yeah.
I just got tired where, you know, the fantasy camp started at $1,200,
$1,400,
$3,000,
$5,000. Oh,
it's terrible. I said, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to do it for the regular Joe guy to have him come do some baseball and make it affordable.
That's a good idea, Bernie. Definitely, yeah. Well, we'll look at the 75 series again. Both of the teams were in a big drought. The Reds haven't won since 1940. Of course, we know the Sox since 1918. The battling back and forth. I had read somewhere too, Bernie, that Clay Carroll from the Reds, your former teammate, inscribed a picture for you, wishing you good luck in the series. And then when you hit a home run off him, he came in and tore it up.
Tore it up, and it looked like a tornado went through my locker. And I asked the clubhouse guy, I said, what's going on? What happened? He said, you hit the home run off of Clay Carroll, and he came in here and tore it. He was looking for that pitcher and tore it up in a million pieces, but he tore my locker apart. But it's funny because I was the only player that played with both teams. I played with
Cincinnati.
And I got myself in trouble when we played the first two games in Boston. We went to Cincinnati during the workout. I went in the clubhouse, and I'm talking to all the Cincinnati players just sitting around. And I said something like, man, I should be playing against you guys. And the next thing you know, it's headlines. Cincinnati player Bernie Carbo says he should be playing against the Cincinnati Reds. And Gerald Johnson calls me in the office and says, hey, look, you know, I don't want any more trouble from you. I'm like, what? I didn't see the paper, so he brings the paper out, and I said, yeah, and I was just in the club. I was just talking with these guys. I didn't say that to a sports writer or whatever, but you know how it is today, man. If we played with all the technology today and all the news and everything, I tell you what, we would be on ESPN. That Boston Red Sox team and a big red machine would be on ESPN every day.
That was a great,
we did some crazy things,
a great bunch of guys, you know? Yeah. Now, you didn't think you'd go up to bat in that situation, did you?
No, you know, it's a funny thing. I was friends with Sparky for a long time. He's like my dad, you know. And even after that series, I talked to him about it. I said, you know, you manage by the book. You know, Will McEnany's a left-hander. I'm a left-handed hitter. He's in the bullpen. I go to the plate, and I tell Juan Benicas, grab a bat. He's going to go to the left-handed pitcher. And the umpire says, come on, you're hitting. And I go up to home plate, and I'm looking at bench. I said, I'm looking for Sparky to come out here and change the pitchers, John.
Yeah.
And John says, nah, we're going to go after you. And then the thing about it, Sparky at the time, when the count was 2-2, he almost made a step up, and he said he was thinking about going to the bullpen and bringing Will McEnany. But since I took such a bad swing on that play, that was like Pete Rose said, it looked like a little leaguer trying to learn how to hit. And Rico said it looked like a guy hurt his arm trying to learn how to hit. And
Rico Petroselli,
Zimmer's down there and said, I got no chance. But, of course, he threw a fastball on the outside. And like I said, when I hit it, I didn't know if it was going to be a home run. So John will turn his back, and I'm rounding second. I'm yelling at Pete Rose. Don't you wish you were this strong, Pete? Don't you wish you were this strong? And Pete's yelling back, man, this is fun, ain't it, Bernie? This is what World Series is about. He said, this is the greatest game he's ever played. This is the greatest game I've ever played. This is great. I'm loving it, you know. Yeah, after it was over with, Sparky said, you know, how can you say this is the greatest game we ever played, you know? We lost. And he said, well, there's a game 7, Sparky. We'll win it. But
yeah.
I had Pete Rose sign a pitcher for me, and he said, thanks for hitting the home run in the World Series because I went 2-for-4 and became MVP.
that's good. We got Bernie Carbo with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. What do you think in the current game of the replay situation, Bernie? It certainly slows the game down.
Yeah. I don't like the replay. I don't like any of that stuff. You know, umpires are umpires. The game is played. We make errors and whatever. You know, speed the game up. Do whatever you want. But the fact is, I'm not. You know, it's a human game. It's a human game. The umpires, ourselves, players, whatever. You know, I think the biggest thing, I think as a fan, what we're seeing is I just don't understand the money that's being paid to these players. I think as a fan and people who watch baseball, get disconnected because life is so hard for us right now to make that dollar and to put food on the table and pay the bills. And you watch a pitcher get $30 million a year, $240 million, and, you know, us old guys, we couldn't get a $1,000 raise, $5,000 raise.
Right.
And, you know, and I look at these guys, and I think, you know, making all this money, there should be something we could give back to the fans, that maybe writing the name the right way, to read the autograph, or to be out in the open.
That's a great point, Bernie. I mean, some of these guys, if they didn't put the number on the autograph, you wouldn't know who the heck it was.
No. And that, you know, I don't understand that fact. You know what I'm saying? I talked about Major League Baseball. You know, I like to see a date night on a Friday night where you bring your date and you can have a free ticket.
Yeah.
Saturday, I like to see double hitters come back. I like to see the double hitter Saturday or Sunday.
Right.
Preferably Saturday, a double hitter, not a split double hitter. Sunday, all the kids come to the ballpark for free. You know, if their dad walks in with them or their mother walks in, the kids come free. Give something back to the fans because, you know, when you're paying $50 parking, $100 for a ticket, I mean, on the Green Monster, you're paying $395 a ticket.
That's it.
And, you know, so, yeah, it's a lot of money. And today I couldn't afford to go to watch a ball game. I remember when we played, bleacher tickets were $1.
Right.
And so, you know, and I remember, I just remember it was affordable and it was fun and you could go watch a game and bring your whole family and things. I think the salaries are just outrageous and I think the prices are outrageous. I think the players are not approachable. Their autographs should be, you know, you should be able to read them. I think a lot of people, you know, they're talking about speeding the game up and, you know, you hear ball players like, well, we should be able to celebrate. Celebrate? Why not celebrate? You hit a home run, guy throws a strike pass, you celebrate, next thing you know, everybody's upset, everybody's mad. You know, bring some characters into the game that, like, we had when we were playing. I mean,
right.
We had a lot of fun. I remember being down in the dugout set in my back on fire. Tell him, the manager, put me in. I'm on fire. Put me in. I'm on fire.
Well, I tell you, Bernie, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I want to thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Yeah, just tell them if they want to read a good book, it's Bernie Carbo. Bernie Carbo. Saving Bernie Carbo, and you can find it on Amazon.
Okay, Saving Bernie Carbo, it's on Amazon. And give your website once more, Bernie.
Yeah, it's B Carbo. BernieCarbo.com. BernieCarbo.com. Go to my webpage. You can pick up a lot of good stuff out of there. It's just, you know, I like to see players having more fun and grinning a little bit more, you know?
I hear you.
I think that would be an enjoyable time to watch players and having fun and enjoying the game again.
Outstanding. Well, thanks again, Bernie.
Go Cubs!
We'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Thanks, Bill.
Take care, Bernie. Bernie Carbo, folks. Up next, we'll talk to Slim Jim Phantom of the Stray Cats about his new book. So stay with us, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Mets doing well. Yankees doing well. Everything is well. So we're going to get to my next guest. Alongside his bandmates Brian Setzer and Lee Rocker, he spearheaded the rockabilly movement in the early 1980s with the Stray Cats. He's from Massapequa, folks. His new book is titled A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. He'll be at Book Review up in Huntington this coming Wednesday night. Welcome in tonight on Sports Talk 1240, Slim Jim Phantom. Jim, good evening.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
All right, great to have you with us.
Yeah. My little dog in the background.
bring it. We'll put him on, too. It's all right. Now, you grow up in Massapequa, Jim. Tell us about your early influences and musical tastes.
Early influences were probably what was on the radio, and we were very much, you know, I had a cousin who had a Rolling Stones record, another cousin who had Billy Joel, and I wanted to be the drummer. So listened to kind of any records I could get a hold of. We had the first Beatles record around the house and a Hank Williams record. And I just wanted to be the drummer, and I just practiced along to any kind of record that I could find. I liked all kind of pop music and, you know, the blues, and there was a couple of, like, big band. There was a Benny Goodman around the house. And and then I started to take lessons in that, and about 1978, 79, myself and the others were always the kind of guys in the band at school, and we all kind of fell on rockabilly around the same time, and really just went one step further back from the Beatles and the Stones, and found rockabilly music that was the original American rock and rollers who influenced everybody, and we just immediately fell in love with it and just launched straight into it.
Now, your particular style with the bass drum and the snare, how did you develop that particular style?
Well, we wanted to really do something different, and we had a conscious plan. Even though we were very young and never really sat down and talked about it so much, we definitely had a plan that we wanted to do something very different.
Yeah.
And when we discovered rockabilly music, there was a few existing old photos. It's not quite as easy now to find anything you want. Like, you had to seek it out a little bit back then. And we know,
yeah,
that, you know, a bunch of the bands, there was upright bass, of course, and you know, a bit of a minimal drum kit. And this is exactly, if you remember the time, 78, 79, it was very much about a lot of equipment.
Right.
On the stage, and we were trying to make a little bit of an anti-statement, and at the same time, you know, who could afford to, you know, lug it all around. We fit all of the Stray Cats and all the gear and a little PA into my 66 Pontiac with us across the front seat and drove, you know,
nice,
all over the island and once a month into CBGB's and Max's trying to get a record deal. But we did, and we used to spend a lot of time in Freeport at the stores. That was one of the best little towns for it.
Yeah, I remember the days of the bands in those in that era. They were more into metal, southern rock. You had Southern Cross, the Stanton, yeah, Anderson band, Swift Kick,
sure,
right?
Yeah, I remember, and all people that I like now, those guys, I remember the names. Like, I see Dee Snider once in a while.
The Good Rats and Twisted Sister. Yeah, there's two more.
You know, Joe Franco is a good drummer. Twisted Sister is like a Long Island Drum Center guy.
Oh, yeah.
Pops, if he's listening. As a musician, I liked everything. You know, all those bands are good, and I liked all those guys. We were really trying to do something different.
Right, and you did. Now, I was in London as a student back in 81. Saw you on Top of the Pops. So we used to watch Top of the Pops every Thursday night before,
yep,
going. We used to go to a pub off the Marylebone Road called Thornbury Castle. They used to have a woman,
okay,
playing piano in there, and we'd sing along and get hammered.
Fantastic.
And
good times in London, then.
Oh,
I was just,
yeah,
there, and it's like happening. You know, London is cool. You know, like when it's not raining, it's, you know, it's like New York, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's happening, and, you know, always something to do.
Now, you lived in Maidenvale, because that's where I was.
We did live in Maidenvale for a little while. We had a tiny flat that the three of us lived in. It was probably, you know, the size of a ping pong table, and there was,
yeah,
three of us.
I was on Sutherland Avenue. We used to go to the Warrington Hotel. I don't know if,
yeah,
you...
Yeah, I was... I gotta tell you, I was there about last week.
Were
so
you?
Funny.
Yeah.
My buddy Glenn Matlock played the Sex Pistols.
Right.
He's a Maidenvale guy, and I was just doing some shows with him and staying at his house. He lives on Castellane Road, which is,
oh,
right,
yeah,
there.
Definitely, yeah, yeah.
I was just at the Warrington last week. That's so funny.
It's such a great pub. It's so ornate, and it's really got a great atmosphere. We used to love it in there.
Stuart Towers, that high rise there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we lived for a few months in that time you're talking about.
We got Slim Jim Phantom tonight on Sports Talk 1240. What other neighborhoods did you live in, Jim? I know you said in the book you lived in Bayswater for a while, Notting Hill Gate.
Yes, I lived for a long time in Chelsea, right next to Stamford Bridge Soccer Grounds. I used to go to stand on the roof,
right,
of my house and watch the games. I lived really between London and L.A. all these years. Now more, a lot more time in L.A., but for a long time was in London, half and half.
And I remember the venue. I never went to the venue, but the guys that I lived with went. I never had the clothes. I mean, you can't walk into the venue with a hoodie on, right?
Oh, Victoria Station, that's where the Stones came to see the Stray Cats. And
right.
That was a happening place. A lot of people played there. It was owned by Richard Branson.
Virgin Airlines,
That was, back then he had Virgin, was a little record label, and he, you know, started out slowly, I guess before he on an airline. You have to own a nightclub. And he had the venue. That was his place.
Yeah, and it, as you said, it was a hopping place.
Everyone played there. It was great, yes.
With Slim Jim Phantom tonight, his new book is called The Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. As I said, he'll be at Book Review Wednesday night up in Huntington Village. Let's talk about some of the people that you hung out with through the years. I remember reading in the book about Carl Perkins and the tribute that you guys did to Carl Perkins. I remember seeing an 8x10 of that in Manhattan somewhere with just the names. Was like a Hall of Fame of rock and roll.
Yeah, Carl Perkins was, you know, a hero to a lot of different generations, and we had worked with him before, probably this is in the mid-'80s, I think, and then Dave Edmonds, who had produced a Stray Cats record, was given the job of putting together a band for a TV show, a tribute to Carl Perkins, and he, Lee and I with the rhythm section and some of the other guests he had on, Eric Clapton, Ringo, and George Harrison, Roseanne Cash, Edmonds. There was a bunch of cool people on it, and it was the beginning of a little friendship I had with George Harrison, who, you know, we met and really got along. He loved rockabilly music, and just really kind of stayed in touch. It was, you know, lucky for me, every now and again, he'd call and say, you know, hey, I'm in L.A., what are you doing? I'm saying,
yeah.
Well, nothing now. He said, you want to go to dinner? Yeah, okay.
Who doesn't want to go to dinner with George Harrison?
Yeah, and he would call every now and again with no regularity. You know, maybe 2 years would go by, and then he would, you know, call out of the blue. He's just a cool guy, and, you know, I'm kind of fortunate that we've had a bunch of those kind of little friendships along the way. You know, George and I, Lemmy was my, you know, like dear, dear pal.
Right.
And there's, you know, Jerry Lee, and does it. Chapter about him and Harry Dean, just my wacky little gang of friends, and it's I kind of saved it until I wrote the book.
Quite a bunch. Now, there's a great story that you talk about with George Harrison. First of all, going to his home in Friars Park, very palatial, and he gets a call from Paul McCartney.
He was talking about. I can't quite remember if it happened while we were there, but he was showing me. He had like a little, well, a big attic at the top of the house, and with all these ornate closets along the side of the room, and in it he had all the Beatles clothes. He had the leather jackets.
Wow.
He had the collarless suits from Ed Sullivan. He had all the crazy Carnaby Street stuff from the 60s, and he had the four Sgt. Pepper suits. I guess he saved them, you know. He picked them up. They probably just dropped it behind at a photo shoot. You never really think about that stuff in the moment, I guess.
Yeah.
And he had all of them. And he said Paul had called him the other day asking him if he had his pepper suit. Paul was doing a video. And he said, yeah, I dug it out for him.
Where's me pepper suit?
You know, he's just telling you the story, like, very matter-of-factly. And I'm like Wally Cleaver, you know. I'm trying to, like, gee whiz, man, really? And so there was some nice moments along the way.
Now, you talk about Lemmy from Motorhead. Now, when I was in London, Please Don't Touch was on the charts with Motorhead and Girls' School. Talk a little bit about Lemmy.
Well, you know, kind of one of my little themes in my book is that rockabilly is a very uniting thing, and the Stray Cats, you know, they were kind of accepted by all the different groups. Whether it was the punks or the, you know, the metal guys or the or the mods or the skinheads or the, you know, the reggae, the Stray Cats were accepted by everybody because rockabilly is just a cool thing. And Lemmy was one of he was really, I think, at the first few shows, the Stray Cats had a little bit of buzz about them, and we were playing in pubs, and Lemmy was one of the, you know, original people to come and check it out. Lemmy's a real, he was a very he was a hipster. He was at the first Sex Pistols and Clash shows. He was at the first shows by the Pretenders. He was at the first shows by the Stray Cats. He was at the first shows by Nirvana, first shows for Guns N' Roses. He's a very intuitive guy, you know, and was there early on with a lot of the stuff, following what he liked. And he and I just became buddies, and then we were very close, and he moved to L.A., and we lived, you know, we shared a parking lot between our buildings, and we just very, very friendly, and like I say, he loved rockabilly, and we recorded two records together, and did a bunch of touring, and he was the real thing, Len, you know? He really was.
Outstanding. Now, you have some great stuff in the book, Jim, about the Rolling Stones, particularly your friendship with Billy Wyman.
Yeah, Bill was another guy. The Stones came early on because they had heard about it, and again, they loved rockabilly, like a bunch of those original English wave of rock and rollers. Their influence was the original American rock and rollers. So
like you mentioned, Keith Richards had said, "We just took your music and repackaged it."
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Keith trying to do an American accent to you know, "Hey man, we just sold your music back to you."
Yeah.
Okay, yo, great. Okay, yeah, we didn't. I just we're having drinks with the Stones at the venue. Yeah, okay, buddy, cool.
Why not? Yeah, yeah.
Whatever you say, man. And then Bill was the one that I became very close with. They had all come to see us, which was pretty a rare occasion for all of the Stones to be at something that wasn't business related or a gig of their own, to like as guys who wanted to see a band. And like I said, they were the Beatles and the Stones and Zeppelin, whoever you want to talk about, the Yardbirds. They were all influenced by the original American rock and rollers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we try to keep that kind of a fresh thought always. This is American music. This is our music.
Right.
And the Beatles and the Stones are happy to tell you that. You know, they loved Carl Perkins and Little Richard and Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. And these were the guys that influenced them.
Right.
And then when the Stray Cats came around, it was three young American guys really doing it up. We attracted those guys.
Mm-hmm. And the rest, they say, is history. Now,
then you got to like make a living at it all.
Yeah, then the hard part comes along. What about Charlie Watts? Now, there's a guy who keeps the beat for the Rolling Stones. Him and the bass player, really, the rhythm section is really what drives the Stones. Any good conversations with Charlie that you can talk about?
Sure, Charlie. We were both shared a love of like jazz drummers. Really, he was.
Yeah.
He was really into Chick Webb and Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and those kind of cats. And I had taken lessons, I think it might have even been in Freeport, from a guy named Mousy Alexander,
uh-huh.
who had played with Benny Goodman.
Benny Goodman, right.
And I used to take the train from Massapequa, just like a few stops, I think it was Freeport, and get off and walk a little bit north. And, you know, Mousy was this fantastic guy. And we're talking mid-70s. This was in the mid-70s. He was not quite that old. He was maybe 70, but he had like a goatee, and he really said hip cap and, you know, crazy man, and he was that guy right there. And I used to go take lessons from him. And I told Charlie these stories, and, you know, he's a fan of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That and how you could put crazy glue on your blisters rather than wrap a Band-Aid around your finger, because sometimes the Band-Aid falls off.
Blisters, exactly. Well, you should have used pickle brine like Nolan Ryan used to use. Maybe that would have done something.
Exactly.
You talk about the killer in the book, Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, there's a name for the ages and certainly a character.
Well, yeah, I spent a little time in his band, and I hung out with the guy 100 times and played gigs, and I'm not 100% sure he recognized me from day to day. He was a guy that we loved, and like Lemmy's favorite probably. I got to him through a guy named Jerry Schilling, who was a close confidant, worked very close with Elvis Presley, and then he went on to manage Jerry Lee, and he was a really good guy, Memphis guy who had moved out to L.A. And I guess Jerry was looking for someone. He recommended me. I went and I got the gig, and just had some wacky adventures with Jerry on the road. And, you know, like a few of the more, G-rated ones are mentioned in the book.
Yeah, unbelievable. Now, you also ran into B.B. King in your travels, and you have a great story about him in there.
Yeah, I'm not telling the punchline, though.
All right, yeah. No, we'll have to get the book to see that. Well, I know what it is, but we'll let the folks find out for themselves. One guy that I was surprised that didn't seem to fit the mold of the whole aura was Jeff Skunk Baxter, Jim.
Jeff is maybe my closest friend. He's my son's godfather.
Yeah.
And we, I see him all the time. He's like a, he's a true character. There's no one like Jeff Baxter. He's, he works, for the U.S. government as a missile defense expert. He, you know, he's keeping the country safe, and at the same time, he's maybe the world's best guitar player.
Yeah.
There's nobody like Jeff Baxter. And,
you're right.
He's, you know, my closest, you know, he's the closest thing I ever had to a big brother. He calls himself my big brother, and like I said, he's my son's godfather. And so we're, you know, he's a true character.
Now, tell us a little bit about, you mentioned the Clash, the Sex Pistols, and some of the guys in the Pretenders. Now, they were all topping the charts back during the time when the Stray Cats were hot. Give us a little insight into the Clash, the Sex Pistols, and the Pretenders.
Well, those guys were a little bit, they were more on a, like a level as being a peer rather than Jerry Lee or someone from the Beatles. For me, I have a certain kind of respect for anyone that I saw on black and white television.
Yeah.
You know, when we were kids. The Clash, the Pretenders, the Pistols, again, they were like guys who are our age, who I was just a little bit before us, who had made fantastic records and really kind of changed the world, I think. Again, they were a part of the earliest crowd that the Stray Cats attracted, because we were kicking around London and everyone heard there's these crazy guys and they finally got a gig. They've been coming around and we've been seeing them on the street. And they finally got a gig. So a bunch of those people, Chrissy Hynde, who I just saw last week.
I think she could beat me up, Jim. I'm kind of scared of her.
She's the best of us all, and we all say that. She really rocks, and she's like super genuine and a great chick, I think.
Yeah, she frightens me a little bit.
People that came to see us originally, and we became kind of friendly on that kind of level. You know, we did shows with the Pretenders and the Clash.
Uh-huh.
Pistols had already ended, but in the new birth of the Pistols, we went and saw them. And I just saw Steve Jones about half an hour ago. We took my little dog for a walk.
Oh, nice. Okay. Now Phantom Rocker and Slick, tell us a little bit about that incarnation.
Well, that was when the Stray Cats made one of our great choices after we just had a couple of multi-platinum albums back-to-back. Let's take a break and make solo records. Okay. So I was in the position of having to make a record. And Lee and I, for that one, we stayed together as a rhythm section. And we needed a guy. And we someone, I believe, at the record company suggested that we get in touch or have a meeting with Earl Slick, who's a Staten Island guy. His dad was a cop. He's one of us, you know, Long Island, Staten Island, New York type guy. He's from the Italian part. We were from the Irish part. We met him and just immediately we could work together and relate to each other. And there was some interest. Well, there was interest right away because the same record company that had the Stray Cats, they have you on the solo record. And so they were very good about it all. And, we got together with Slick and we wrote songs relatively quickly and found out that we could write quickly. And then we worked on it. And we made those first, the records. There was one in 86, 87, I think. We made two of them. And I just love the guy. He's like another guy that I still speak to. I still hang out with. He's my buddy.
Yeah. Sounds good. Now, I know you're a baseball fan. You're a Yankee fan, correct?
Yep. Don't miss an inning.
All right.
On the road watching it on my laptop in Germany at 4 in the morning.
What do you think?
MLB.com, baby.
Yeah. Can't beat it, I know.
No.
What do you think of the rebuilding that the Yankees are doing now, Jim?
I think it's great, and I think everyone is going to be patient with it.
Because
I think when they bail on big salaries and they show that they're bringing people up, you have to remember that we had Mo and Jeter, George, Bernie. These were all guys that came up through the farm system. And
right.
I think
it happened once before.
And I think the fans are patient.
Okay.
When it's building from within like that. Well, I kind of like the new way.
Cashman certainly he certainly did his job in bringing in some good prospects. And they had a good basis in the minor leagues to bring up Judge, to bring up guys like Gary Sanchez. And we'll see what happens. That's it. Now, how do you feel about
Francis? He's a closer of the future. I think he's going to be like another one of those guys.
They still have a solid pen. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Now, what did you think the way I'll use the term treated A-Rod?
Well, I'm going to maybe say the first controversially. I like Alex Rodriguez.
Right. Okay. A lot of people do.
The outlaw guys. I like all the outlaw guys.
Yeah.
If anyone's a guy that nobody likes, I like him.
So yeah.
It's because, he's a punk rocker. and I think it's good. I think he made his mistakes, and then he apologized in his own way, I think, and went out of his way to be a good guy. And who knows? I think he's a genuine Hall of Famer, and we'll see. And
you think he'll hook up?
I like the guy. Huh?
You think he'll hook up with somebody else?
Hook up with another team? Well, I don't know. I hope not. I still can't get used to seeing Cano on a different team. That one hurt a little bit.
Yeah, he's kind of out of the picture now in Seattle. You don't really hear much from Robinson.
Yeah, I just kind of depressing. I have five fantasy teams, so I got to follow everybody a little bit. So.
Do you see a plaque coming down the road for A-Rod, do you think?
Well, it's going to be one of those things that gets talked about a lot, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. He's going to fall into that, Sosa, Maguire, that whole argument. Well, who's the guy that I don't think? Palmeiro. You don't even hear about him being mentioned anymore.
No, I think he's so far out of it that the only way he'll get into Cooperstown is to buy a ticket.
So 500 homers in that age isn't a guarantee anymore.
And 3,000 hits. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
It's all due to that era. You're exactly right. Now, what do you think of the replay situation, Jim, in baseball these days? Slim Jim Phantom with us from the Stray Cats tonight.
I think it's a bit of a funny thing. It's
very strange, isn't it? All of a sudden the game stops. These guys put on headsets. You wonder what they're listening to, Could
don't
be Top of the Pops.
To New York, some giant database, like a central thing?
Yeah, there's like a bunker in Chelsea that there's another umpiring crew sitting there watching.
Wow.
And, that's who they're talking to, believe it or not.
And it doesn't seem like it, like football, to me, it seems like everything. It takes half an hour, and they go to a commercial. It seems like baseball, kind of as being a purist, I don't like it so much.
Yeah.
But they really do get it right now. That poor guy that lost a perfect game a few years ago, he would have he'd have a perfect game if it wasn't for him.
He would. Yeah, that's a shame. Really
shame. The guy for Detroit, I think it was.
Yeah.
The one time you'll ever hear of him.
And the umpire apologized to him.
Yeah.
What a shame.
But I don't know what else they can do. I mean, they've still got, it's perfect.
What are the evolution? What are you going to do?
60 feet, 6 inches,
yeah.
And somehow 9 players. It's perfect, isn't it? It really is. I love it.
It works out wonderfully, yeah. Now, what's a day with Slim Jim Phantom like these days? What are you doing currently?
Well, exactly at this time I'm doing some promo for the book. I'm going to New York tomorrow and doing some signings. This week here in L.A., I did a signing at my local bookstore. That's kind of cool. It's a place I've been to 100 times already. And a bunch of pals came out to it. Kind of left to my own. If I'm not doing that, I let, I go walk my little dog with Steve Jones in the hills and we go to lunch and
hang out with a Sex Pistol. Yeah.
Yeah, there's kind of a gang of lazy, guys who aren't on the road. I went to Guns N' Roses the other night. That was really fun. They're, Duff's an old pal. And that was kind of cool at Dodger Stadium. Really. And, I do gigs. I was in England just after 6 weeks doing a bunch of festivals and a bunch of gigs. And it really just worked to hustle it all up, keep it all going. And I have two kids that are a little bit grown now. So, I just wait for stuff to happen now, kind of.
Yeah, okay. Now,
definitely baseball. I do my fantasy. I got like five teams. That's part of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, see, I'm a Met fan, so I'm having a rough time right now. But I had my season last year. But, again, they're like the Jets. They'll break your heart every year.
Yeah, technically where we lived, I would have been Mets. But I'm a nerd for baseball. I love, you know, the history of the Yankees and the whole, really, the history to it all.
You ever been to Cooperstown, Jim?
No.
That's a place you have to get to.
I'm kind of embarrassed. It's kind of hard to get to. So I'm
it's in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, I went to the induction this year. It's really in the middle of nowhere, and it takes you about 5 hours from the island. And, it's rough.
I went to New Yankee Stadium last year, and I go there every time I'm anywhere near because you can get the train. But, Cooperstown, I'm a little embarrassed. I haven't been able to work it out.
You will. You'll get there. When A-Rod goes in, you'll get there. Well, I tell you, Jim, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us. The book is called A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. Again, Jim will be at Book Review in Huntington this coming Wednesday night at 7. I will be there, Jim, and I will say hi to you.
Oh, good. Come by and say hello, and we'll, you know, talk some baseball.
We'll do.
More
all right.
Baseball. I'd rather talk about that than rock and roll any day.
All right. Well, you take care, Jim, and we'll have to make a date to get to the Warrington.
You got it. Thanks, buddy.
Take care. Slim Jim Phantom, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Bernie Carbo and Slim Jim Phantom, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next Sunday, August the 28th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.